Christian Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents To Be Made Well, An Invitation to Wholeness, Healing, and Hope by Amy Julia Becker. Narrated by Amy Julia Becker. Forward. As I lay dying in a hospital bed at 26 years old, as I sit across the table from a mom devastated by the grief of her story, as I read the article, Crying Out for Justice After Unimaginable Loss, the question is always the same. Will I be healed? Will we be healed? And then a deeper question remains. What does healing even mean? This may be the ultimate struggle of our humanity. Knowing we have this glorious welling up of great possibility in us, of golden dreams, but finding it all, more often than not, just out of our reach. We are wounded, we are disabled, we are in pain, we are grieving, we are lost. And the juxtaposition between what could be but is not yet and may never be is almost too much to bear. On an ordinary day in April 2008, I suffered a catastrophic and nearly fatal stroke. Completely out of the blue as my six-month-old baby napped and my husband finished his final law school presentation in the next room. Our lives were upended in a moment, and my near-lifeless body lay in an ICU bed on life support for months afterward. A beautiful community of friends and family and internet strangers prayed and loved us through that terrible season. From around the world, visions and dreams of me bounding out of the hospital like a modern-day Jairus's daughter, resurrected from the dead, began to flow to our inboxes and hearts. Healing would come. Everyone was hoping and praying and believing it would be so. And yet months later, I could barely breathe or move on my own, much less run back into the world as if nothing had happened. The dreams of healing from our community and in our own hearts began to fade. The grief of unanswered prayers was perhaps the deepest we have ever experienced. As time passed, I gradually got better and better, more of a slow-motion miracle than the instantaneous type. And I did desire to share my story, telling people about how Jesus had healed me. But I certainly didn't plan to tell it from a wheelchair. Yet as many more years of recovery passed and significant disabilities remained, it became clear that no amount of prayers or tears or magical cures would restore the part of my brain that had been removed to save my life. This second chance would include a wheelchair and would look nothing like the life I had imagined living. But then there were the stories. Over years of meeting people living through similarly unresolved questions, of hearing stories of disability and trauma and hope, our hearts opened to the possibility of redefining healing. And stories, like the one Amy Julia Becker has lived and told, helped us reimagine everything. In a season when we longed to know we were not alone in the unique isolation and wounding of disability, her book, A Good and Perfect Gift, opened our eyes to the gift of the life and the miracle right in front of us. White Picket Fences poignantly put words around my similar longings to steward my privilege and hurts for the cause of my co-sufferers. And now this book, To Be Made Well, which may be my favorite yet, draws on all these separate but interconnected themes. This book is as personal as it is universal. It has not been formed theoretically from pages in libraries. Rather, it has been lived out and embodied in community. This is a guidebook full of hard-earned insight. This is a trail blazed through the wilderness. If my own story of longing for healing and finding hope in the process has taught me anything, it's that this lifelong journey of heartbreaking and remaking is most powerfully done together. My story of disability has offered a bigger reality that none of us can do this life alone, nor were we meant to. We need God, and we need each other. And in this universal longing for healing, we can't find what we're looking for alone either, nor were we meant to. I'm so grateful for Amy Julia's vulnerable and wise offering in this book. It may just be the beginning of your own redefining. May the places of our deepest wounding eventually also be the places of our deepest healing. May that healing come in ways we never imagined. May the upending of our lives help us better see the upside-down kingdom of God. And may we all be made well together. Catherine Wolfe, founder of Hope Heals and author of Hope Heals and Suffer Strong. Introduction. I started throwing up when I was 14 years old. It began on a Friday night in December, a few hours after our family of six enjoyed a special dinner in the restaurant of a local hotel. The lobby looked festive, with white lights and greenery and holiday music in the background. A magician moved from table to table, hiding coins and pulling scarves out of unexpected crevices. My little sisters giggled with delight. It came time to order dinner, and I faced a decision. I hadn't eaten a full meal in weeks. Earlier that fall, I had vowed to limit myself to 1,000 calories per day. I wrote this goal in my journal and signed it, a pledge to myself and to the gods of thinness. I had just come home from fall term at a boarding school, so my mother wasn't aware of my dramatic shift in eating. She would have registered concern about my new diet of apples, frozen yogurt, bagels, and salad. That night, I broke my pledge. I ordered fajitas and an ice cream sundae. I wanted the pretense of normalcy. I didn't want my family to notice that anything had changed. The food tasted sumptuous, but I worried about what the scale would tell me in the morning. Once we returned to our house, I decided to balance out the meal by riding the stationary bike in our attic. My dad worked out twice a day, so even at the odd hour of 9 at night, no one in my family thought much about my decision to exercise. The surprise came just before I got in the shower, when I threw up. I didn't feel nauseated. I didn't gag. It was more like a polite, unexpected, not even entirely unpleasant regurgitation. I mentioned it with a shrug to my mom the next morning. But then it happened again the next night, and the next. Within a few weeks, I was involuntarily regurgitating everything that went into my body. In February, I was admitted to the hospital for observation. The plan was to feed me scrambled eggs with radioactive particles and then watch those eggs move through my digestive tract. But the eggs didn't move. They sat in my gut. "Your stomach walls look gray," my gastroenterologist said, "like the stomach of a 90-year-old. The technical diagnosis was gastroparesis. My stomach was paralyzed. Identifying the cause of the problem didn't make a difference. I couldn't keep down any food. I was losing weight. I took medication to improve motility, but it didn't help. After a year of painful blood draws and tests and tubes that never amounted to much change in my condition, we tried acupuncture and biofeedback. I tried a diet restricted to simple, soft foods. I tried drinking only Ensure. I tried prayer. Members of our church gathered around me, prayed for healing, and anointed me with oil. And Shirley Pray, an elder whose spiritual gifts fit her name, said to me gently after the anointing, 'This one will take a long time.' I went on and off intravenous fluids, in and out of the hospital, became familiar with fainting from rising too fast. Those early months turned into 5 years of struggle. A part of me wanted to get better, but mostly I felt relieved that I could eat without fear of what the scale would report, and relieved that I couldn't be blamed for self-harm. I had friends with anorexia and bulimia who were in and out of treatment centers and therapist offices, but I could tell myself and my parents and teachers and doctors that my body was inexplicably malfunctioning and I simply needed a medical cure. Looking back decades later, I vacillate between calling this illness an eating disorder and accepting the medical diagnosis of gastroparesis. I can see my unhealthy mindset around food, but my body also was clearly impaired. I still don't have the words to combine the bodily and psychological reality. Pulling the threads of the physical and the emotional aspects of my situation only results in a tighter knot. Even now, when I think of how often as an adult I've succumbed to illness in a time of stress, or when I think of friends lying in bed from migraines while managing the pressure of childcare and working at home during a pandemic, or when I read about the increase in debilitating back pain and substance use disorders and anxiety in the modern era, I see in myself and in our culture an inability to connect the physical, emotional, spiritual, and social aspects of who we are. And I, like many others, feel a longing for that connection, a longing for healing. 2 years into my illness, my boyfriend at the time, and now my husband, confronted me. He had noticed how I excused myself from every meal. He noticed my dry, brittle hair and skinny limbs. He noticed my evasive answers to questions about food. He asked me to count how often I threw up in a day. The next night I told him, 8 times. Peter insisted I needed help, and I was both ashamed and relieved to agree with him. This time I felt certain that the answers would come from uncovering my emotions around food and my body. So I went to therapy. I met with a nutritionist. I ate as she instructed, and I gained 20 pounds over the course of a few months. Until one day, I broke. I returned to the familiar pattern. Soon thereafter, I found myself in the emergency room. Routine blood work indicated my heart was in danger of stopping. I was 17 years old. As I saw it, doctors had failed me. Therapy and nutritionists had failed me. And prayer had failed me. I had wanted God to swoop in and offer an immediate and miraculous change to my body. And that didn't happen. All I had left was myself. 4 years in, I set a goal of only throwing up twice each day, then a goal of once a day, then once every other day. It was miserable. I hated the changes to my body. I hated the sensation of forcing food into my stomach. But I also wanted to get well. I started to take small steps that seemed to actually make a difference. I stopped buying magazines like Self and Shape and Glamour, with images of women in bathing suits and promises of the next great food or exercise fad on their covers. I memorized Bible verses about how God cares about our hearts and not about the way our bodies look. And I started to receive physical therapy for my stomach. Once a week, I lay on a table, passive, receptive, and talked as Kim, the physical therapist, pressed on my abdomen and kneaded my paralyzed organs back to life. She asked basic questions like, "What's your favorite food?" When I talked about how much I loved French fries, my stomach audibly gurgled, as if the prospect of that nourishment and pleasure demanded a bodily response. For years, I had carefully separated the physical and mental aspects of my being. But telling Kim simple stories about my parents, my sisters, my boyfriend, my school, combined with her gentle massage, seemed to knit me back together. I could feel my stomach wake up. Over the course of a few months of weekly sessions, I finally began to get well. I didn't have the language for it at the time, but I was learning that our modern medical system, as marvelous and innovative as it is, has tremendous limits when it comes to healing. I recognized this disconnect again in my mid-20s when my mother-in-law was diagnosed with cancer and doctors could recommend treatments but didn't know how to offer care as she faced the reality of a terminal illness. I ran into it when our oldest daughter was diagnosed with Down syndrome and received labels of defective and abnormal, as if who she was as a person could be reduced to a category called disability. I saw it again in my 30s when my back began to hurt and I couldn't explain where the pain came from. And I needed this understanding when our nation entered a global pandemic and a time of racial reckoning, when a biomedical approach to healing was not enough to care for our wounded souls or our divided society. Most people do not have such an extreme story of illness and disorder at such a young age. But all of us have been taught to isolate our bodies from our minds and our spirits. Many of us have physical ailments that stem from stress or heartache, whether it's the minor affliction of a cold sore on a lip or the major disruption of a chronic condition. And even when we do not carry our emotional pain within our own bodies, our bodies nevertheless feel the pain and division of the world around us. We live in a society that assumes our personal and collective pain can be addressed through biomedical fixes. For Christians and other people of faith, we often hope for our own version of a fix through miraculous intervention. Sometimes surgeons or prayer can instigate immediate physical changes in our bodies. But even then, and especially when we wait and wait and wait without any change arriving, we are in need of a more comprehensive healing. As much as modern medicine can play a crucial role in our lives, it is nevertheless not enough to restore us, individually or collectively, to health. We need a broader and deeper understanding of healing in order to be made well. This book is an exploration of this type of healing, comprehensive, personal, spiritual, and communal restoration to a life-giving relationship with God. Looking at stories about Jesus, and especially the story of a synagogue leader and a bleeding woman in Mark's gospel, part one addresses the nature of Jesus's healing. This healing is for our whole selves, mind, body, and spirit. This healing is an invitation for each of us and all of us to know God's love personally. This healing is also a call to be received by and restored to community. Part two considers how distraction, shame, anxiety, and injustice can keep us from healing. And part three explores ways we are all invited to receive God's healing love, just as we are all invited to participate in extending that abundant love toward others. My own longing for healing and wholeness began when I couldn't figure out a way to piece my body and soul together, when doctors, alternative medicine, therapists, and my own willpower didn't have the answers. Within all that confusion, I did turn to God. I didn't receive a quick fix, but I did receive a sense of God's presence. God was with me, even if my prayers weren't answered the way I thought they should be. I've now walked alongside others on their own journeys toward wholeness, and I have seen how healing can happen even in the midst of ongoing pain and unanswered questions. I now wonder whether God's refusal to cure my illness with a quick miracle was, in and of itself, an invitation to a deeper work of healing. I emerged from those years of illness with a better understanding of how my body and mind and emotions were interrelated, with a deeper faith and with a greater sense of purpose in the world. I was like the blind man healed by Jesus in John's gospel. 2,000 years later, I echoed his words. I don't know who it was who healed me. I just know I once was blind, and now I see. Part 1, The Nature of Healing. Chapter 1, Restored to Self. A woman was there who had been subject to bleeding for 12 years. She had suffered a great deal under the care of many doctors and had spent all she had. Yet instead of getting better, she grew worse. When she heard about Jesus, she came up behind him in the crowd and touched his cloak, because she thought, if I just touch his clothes, I will be healed. Immediately her bleeding stopped, and she felt in her body that she was freed from her suffering. Mark chapter 5, verses 25 through 29. When our kids were 6, 4, and 1, we moved to a new town. My husband Peter had been hired as the head of an independent boarding school, and while I was still trying to write essays and blog posts and even books, I became more than ever the primary household manager and the default parent. Sometime within that first stressful year, my lower back began to ache. During the day, I rarely noticed it, but at night, I woke up and squirmed as I fought to get comfortable. I tried exercises to strengthen my core. I tried stretching. I tried a pillow under my knees. Nothing really helped. I mostly overcame the pain and the accompanying sleeplessness with 2 Advil from the top drawer of the bathroom vanity, nestled alongside the hairbands and nail clippers. Sometimes I included a Tylenol PM or melatonin in the cocktail of pain relief. Over the course of a few years, what had been intermittent pain became constant. The medication became a necessity. The nightly Advil habit nagged at me. I didn't want to live the rest of my life popping pills in the dark. But then the pain began to creep toward my tailbone. I told our daughter Merrily, 4 years old by this time, that I couldn't pick her up anymore because it strained my back. I told William and Penny that it hurt me to have them sit on my lap. Those conversations brought with them both a sense of failure. I was supposed to be able to hold them close, and relief that I could reclaim a little bit of my sense of self. I didn't want to be blamed for having needs for things like time alone or personal space. I wanted instead to blame my body. Stretching, core strengthening, medication. A self-prescribed Sisyphean regimen. I finally reached out to a yoga teacher whom a friend recommended. Maybe she could identify postural problems or guide my body into better balance or offer some stretches to practice every day. It seemed worth a try. Anne is thin, strong, willowy, with long straight blonde hair. She wears cashmere cardigans and loose flowy shirts atop leggings. She arrived at our back door with a gentle smile and a yoga mat. We walked upstairs together, and then she invited me with a gesture to sit cross-legged on the floor facing her. This is going to hurt, I thought. But I am nothing if not obedient to authority, so I took my uncomfortable seat. She said, "Tell me why we're here." I told her the story of my back trouble and all my attempts to cure the pain. I told her I thought I had a problem with alignment, and I wondered if she could help. She nodded. "Whenever I hear the word alignment," she said, "I tend to think of what is out of balance in your life, not primarily in your body." Regardless of whether she meant for me to do so, I took the prompt and spilled the story about the move 3 years earlier and Peter's job and my sense of failure as a writer and at home. There was the daily race against the clock with Merrily at school for 3 hours each morning and dozens of doctor's visits for all of us, and especially Penny, who rotates through a gauntlet of specialists who typically affirm her good health and suggest another appointment in 6 months' time. Then there was the role I played as wife of the head of school, whereby I showed up at parties and dinners and banquets and ceremonies and generally drank too much wine while trying to stay present and pleasant. There was the corresponding sense of losing myself, as the dial on the scale crept upward and the thought of a night without alcohol felt impossible. It unraveled this disjointed tale of what had started to feel like a meaningless existence. I was playing the role of supportive spouse and loving mother, while the core of who I was had become so slippery it seemed in danger of sliding out of my grasp. Added to all that was the guilt of complaining about a life of wealth, safety, education, and relative health. The fear of not fulfilling my potential as a woman with an Ivy League education and a master's degree. The shame of not engaging with the real problems and injustices of the world because it all felt too big and overwhelming, and I could hardly manage to take care of myself. I talked about how, even though I didn't like to admit it, I knew my back pain might be connected to all this emotional angst. By this time, I understood those years of gastroparesis and bulimia as a physical response to a set of emotional and psychological problems. Underneath my surface teenage desire to be as thin as possible were layers of disordered thinking, my need for control, my unwillingness to acknowledge any anger or hurt from family dysfunction, my belief that if I could only get everything right, then I would be lovable. Maybe something similar was happening now, in a subtler form, through this persistent back pain. I sat cross-legged in the dim light of our hallway on a yoga mat, and I talked and talked and talked. We didn't move. For an hour, Anne asked questions that led me deeper into the story of my past and closer to admitting my discontent in the present. As I shared, it was as if the pain in my back had been stored up behind a valve that slowly opened and now allowed all that discomfort to seep out. Then, suddenly, my tailbone stopped hurting. At first, I didn't say it out loud. I didn't believe it could be true. But I hadn't felt this measure of relief in months. So as we neared the end of our session, I said, "I feel kind of bashful admitting this, but it seems to be all better now." Anne nodded, as if this type of healing was as familiar to her as sunshine. "It doesn't usually happen this quickly," she said. "I think your experience in high school has helped you see the connection between your mind and your body." "But I haven't figured it all out," I said. Feeling this kind of immediate relief didn't compute. I could see how the jumble of stories of my own self-doubt and identity loss was connected to this back pain. I also knew that talking about their reality hadn't changed anything about my situation as a wife, mother, or writer. I hadn't taken any steps to solve the problem. Nothing was fixed. Why would my back feel better so quickly? "You don't need to figure it out for healing to begin. You just need to acknowledge the source of the pain," Anne said. "That pain will try to come back," she continued. "You need to develop a way to respond when it does. The lower back is the source of support for your whole body. So when you feel pain there, you can remind yourself, 'I am supported.'" I couldn't make sense of it. But that morning, I had experienced some sort of healing, and I wanted to continue on this healing path. So when I was steering our minivan down the windy road into town and my back started to throb, I repeated in my head, "I am supported." I envisioned the people who support me, Peter, friends, colleagues, and I turned those words of self-affirmation into a prayer to the one who supports the cosmos itself and me within it. I still had a lot of questions. Where did this healing come from? How did it work? Was personal healing just another form of self-help? Was it simply a sweet gift from God so I could feel better? Was there a larger purpose? Healing began as something passive. When I was sitting with Anne and telling my story, I felt relief come upon me, like grace. Over time, when the pain crept back, I prayed through it. I began to ask God to help me understand what message my body was bringing when new aches and illnesses arose. Relief from pain was only the beginning. That moment also offered an invitation to explore shame and fear and loneliness, an invitation to experience wonder and delight and joy, an invitation to participate in a larger work of healing. After that day with Anne, I began to read the Bible with new curiosity about Jesus as a healer. I turned to the stories in the Gospels, and as I did, I noticed the ubiquity of Jesus' healing work. On practically every page, someone gets healed. Often there's a sweeping statement about Jesus healing all the sick people who came to him on
Sample complete. Ready to continue?